General Government. It is Wednesday, February 16th. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 5001.
Anne-Marie, are you ready to go? Great. We're staffed today by Anne-Marie Housley from Dallas Wyman,
and would invite the agency to come up. This is an acronym-free environment, and so if you'd come forward, please, and introduce yourselves for the record and spell your last names, if you wouldn't mind.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carol Reeves. My name is spelled R-I-V as in victory, E-S, and I am the administrator for the Board of Accountancy.
And good morning, Madam Chair. I'm Satish Upadhyay with the Department of Administrative Services.
Good morning.
Good morning. Would you like me to begin?
Please, if you would.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, the mission of the Oregon Board of Accountancy is to protect the public through the regulation of licensed certified public accountants, and public accounting firms. Licensees of this board provide a broad array of services to both individuals, to large and small businesses, to public and private companies, municipalities, and governmental agencies. The public value of these services is derived from the professional standards, including the professional code of conduct, that licensed accountants are required to follow. The Board of Accountancy safeguards the public through its regulation that assures that licensed accountants in Oregon meet minimum standards of competency upon initial licensing and perform services according to professional standards. The goals of the Board of Accountancy are to maintain high standards of the profession, to continue to develop professional uniformity with other states so long as public protection is not diminished in the process, and to enhance our information technology tools to improve our public service and to achieve cost efficiencies in the same process. Historically, the Board of Accountancy has rather an enviable history. We were created in 1913 for the purpose of providing public protection. And while I wasn't here at the time, I am advised that the Board of Accountancy in Oregon was one of the first of the states to develop a practice act. If not the first, it was among the first. Our most recent 10-year statistics indicate a 25% increase in the number of our individual licensees through the current year. We have gone from 5,669 to 7,198, and we have a 100% increase in our registered public accounting firms. The primary responsibility for public protection by the State Board of Accountancy is unchanged. It is still accomplished through licensing and through its compliance and enforcement activities. However, board requirements and needs to assure public protection have changed over the years. Most notably, the board implemented a peer review requirement in 1981. In this requirement, Oregon was the first of the 54 jurisdictions to require peer review of its licensees who perform attest services. The board also implemented a continuing education requirement in ethics in the year 2000, and this is an ethics program that is particularly pays attention to Oregon laws and rules. The board adopted a broader independent standard in the year 2004. They adopted the independent standard that is promulgated by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants. And also in 2004, which was a historical year for the profession, the Uniform Certified Public Accountancy Act exam was transformed from a paper and pencil exam to a computer-based exam. This was a great change, both for the people who are giving the exam and for those who are taking the exam. We believe that the new exam format provides a more relevant format for candidates to become familiar with and a more secure testing format. Board operations are conducted under a single budget program. All of our revenue sources are other funds. They are derived from licensing fees, exam fees, sale of lists, and other public information, and, of course, from our civil penalties. The board...
May I interrupt you for a moment? Sale of lists. Mm-hmm. Fill us in a little bit on that.
That's a quick way to say it, but not a particularly flattering one, or not a particularly popular one. Anyone who makes a request of the board for public information is entitled to receive it within a reasonable amount of time. The most frequently requested piece of information that the board holds is a list of its licensees in various formats. Some marketing, perhaps someone is marketing continuing education programs, and they want to know the names of those people in Oregon to whom they could market their programs. Or perhaps someone wants to market an exam preparation program for the uniform CPA exam, and they want to market to candidates for the exam, and so they ask us to provide them with a list of the candidates. So it's these lists of names that are most frequently requested from our public records.
And I presume they have addresses with them?
They may ask for addresses, yes.
And what steps are in place to safeguard other private information that you may have about your licensees? I'm thinking social security numbers or any other forms of personal identification that would be on those lists.
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. That's an important question. First of all, the board gathers very little private information. We are required to gather a social security number for the purpose of the child enforcement laws. We gather that from our new licensees on a separate sheet of paper, and after we receive them, they are filed in a locked cabinet. They are not on our database, so they're not available. Lists are compiled from the database, so they're not ever going to come up on the database. Licensees also are required to provide us with two addresses, their business address and their residential address. If it's the same, of course, then it's one address. They may also provide us with a post office box as their official address. If they choose to do that, it is the official address that is the address we will provide to someone who's requesting a list. So if someone wants to protect their residential address from unwanted mail, they only need to give us a post office address for their additional address. They need to give us the other address because that's one of our requirements, but their official address will be placed in the licensee database, will be the post office. So they may protect their own position as to unwanted mail.
Thank you.
In that way.
Senator Morsa, good morning.
Good morning. I think you've answered the questions in terms of privacy. Has anyone ever requested that their name not be distributed to any particular group?
Madam Chair and Senator Morissette, yes. Another very appropriate question. We have had licensees who have complained that they don't want their name on these mailing lists. Unfortunately, we don't have that choice. It is a public record, and we have to respond. There are exemptions to the public record, and one of them goes to safety of that individual and their family. If that individual can show that they or their family would be in danger because of their address being in a public domain, then they may seek the exemption that is in the Public Records Act. And we have had one licensee whose husband was a police officer, and she was able to obtain that. We were able to accommodate her request under that exemption. But that's very infrequent that a person will qualify there.
Well, may I?
Hello.
Yeah. The important thing is that there is a process that they can go through to take care of that. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Indeed.
Okay, please continue.
Thank you. Let's see, we were talking about the board being an other fund agency, and the derivation of our revenue is from licensing fees, civil penalties, and miscellaneous income. Our licensing activities are probably the first priority of the board because this is the activity that ensures that those people who become licensed have minimal competencies before they are able to perform services for the public under the Certified Public Accountant designation. The first activity in this regard is, of course, the Uniform Certified Public Accountancy Exam. This is a uniform exam given across the country. In every state, it has been accepted as the exam, and it has been, I think, administered since the 1950s in this fashion. The board's role in this, number one, is to accept applications for the exam, determine eligibility of the candidates to take the exam. Once approved, then to monitor that candidate's progress through the various sections of the exam, and finally to approve and issue the grades, release the grades to the individuals for their performance on the exam. The second portion of this would be the initial licensing of applicants. An individual who has passed the exam then may apply for licensing, but they must also show that they have achieved the education standards and that they have also achieved the experience requirements before they may be licensed. So the initial licensing of certified public accountants, public accounting firms, and municipal auditors fall within this aspect of our services. Finally, in the licensing portion of our activities, we are also responsible for renewing licensees on a regular basis and ensuring that they maintain competency throughout the licensing period, and reinstating those licensees who, for some reason or other, have fallen off out of saddle and want to get back on. These may be folks who have allowed their license to lapse. They may be folks who have gone inactive for a perfectly legitimate reason and now choose to become active again. There may also be people whose licenses have been suspended for one reason or another, and they have to meet certain requirements before they may be reinstated, again to ensure that before they are actively providing services that they demonstrate competency to the board. The second program area of activity that the board engages in is its compliance and enforcement programs. In the compliance arena, I would like to mention the continuing education requirement. This is one of the main avenues that the board has to ensure that licensees, as they are renewed, are maintaining their competency. Licensees are required to obtain 80 hours of continuing education each renewal period. They are two-year renewal periods. And the education that they acquire, they must be able to demonstrate that these particular programs contribute to their professional competency. They do this by a certification and by our review of the education reports that they provide us. Another very important aspect of our compliance program is what is called peer review oversight. Peer review is a process by which the work of one licensee is reviewed by another licensee for competency. And the only work that is subject to the peer review requirement is services that are called attest services. These are the services that provide assurance to third parties that the financial statements that have been reported on are trustworthy and properly presented. Obviously, in the compliance and enforcement area, we have our investigatory arm and disciplinary actions. We investigate complaints for the purpose of preventing the recurrence of violations and also to ensure compliance with our rules through disciplinary sanctions. An investigation may be brought to the board's attention by means of a written complaint from an outsider. May not be an outsider, might be another licensee. We may also receive information through the newspaper of events that we believe are within our jurisdiction that we have an obligation to look at. They may come to the attention of the board through our administrative process, and a complaint or an investigation is opened administratively. So there are many avenues by which a complaint may be obtained and acted upon. After the complaint process is completed, then a completed investigation report is provided to the board's complaints committee for review and recommendation to the board, and finally to the board for final determination, because the board is the decision-making authority. Within our compliance and enforcement area of activities, we also include a certain amount of outreach to both licensees and to the public through our website, through development of more and more internet accessibility, and through various publications that we make available. The third area of our activities would probably relate to administrative or board support. This includes regularly scheduled meetings of the board. The board meets six times a year. Two of those meetings are two-day sessions. a work session that we conduct in the spring and again in the fall. And it is at those work sessions that the board has the opportunity to take more time for deliberation of professional issues, revisions that may need to be made, changes in their strategic planning, reassessing their goals, reviewing their administrative performance of the administrative staff, reports from each of the committees. Things that cannot be done in a single day meeting are conducted in these work sessions. Also in board support is the administrative support of five standing committees. The board has five committees that assist it in its regulatory responsibilities. These committees are the Continuing Education Committee, the Complaints Committee, the Qualifications Committee, the Committee for the Professional Code of Conduct, and finally, AP Review Oversight Committee.
Ms. Reeves, may I stop you? While you're here in this administrative area and seeing your colleague from the Board of Tax Preparers in the audience, I would like you, for the benefit of the committee, to comment on what, if anything, you do collaboratively with the Board of Tax Preparers or could do with the board. And I guess by asking you this question, I'm putting your colleague on notice that this might be something we'll discuss with him as well.
Yes, Madam Chair, you're speaking from an administrative point of view, selectively? Administratively, we do exchange information regarding investigations. Very often a complaint or a question will come to our board or to their board, and in fact the jurisdiction is in the other agency's hands. And so we will exchange that information. Many of them are cooperative investigations. There may be jurisdiction on both areas, and so we cooperate in that way. Administratively, we share the same office space, and we share expenses of common space in our area. We share equipment so that we can reduce costs by not having each one to own a lot of heavy equipment that is not necessary. A small agency doesn't need to have full ownership of.
Let me be more blunt.
I guess.
Have you thought about melding the two boards, given that you're sharing common space, you're sharing equipment? It seems to me that you have enough interests in common to meld the two agencies into one.
Yes,
find some administrative savings there.
Madam Chair, that suggestion has been made. Of course, it was the subject of an interim study by the Legislative Audit Committee, and the study itself expanded into an address to other questions beyond the combination of these two boards. And it has caused us to have discussions among ourselves about the possibility. We have not looked at it in a detailed way because we were waiting for the study to result in any recommendations that were made by the study. We do feel, or I at least feel, that the group of people who are under regulation by each of these boards are a very different group in the services that they provide and the customers that they provide them to. The tax board provides a very limited service. That is people who are licensed. That is that they provide assistance for the preparation of individual tax returns. Professional licensed accountants provide a very broad base of services, from tax preparation to audits on financial statements to management consulting, and they are now expanding out to financial advice, estate advisory services. It's a much broader spectrum, and I think that may present some difficulties just in trying to glue those two pieces together when they are a very different group of licensees.
Have the two boards discussed it at all?
Not on a serious measure, no, madam, because of the study and the results that we were anticipating before we took this matter up.
I'm going to ask the professional staff, Mr. Wernon, how voluminous is the study that was produced in the interim?
You each have received copies. It's not that large, I think.
Okay.
With the responses.
I'm sorry, I didn't know that we had.
It's not in here. It was a separate report that was issued by the audit committee. It was delivered to every member's office. We can certainly
Well, now we'll have to go back and find it.
It was issued in December.
When was it delivered? December?
No. In December, yes.
To our office?
Yes.
Okay.
And the findings, if I may go to the...
Please.
Cut to the chase with the recommendation. it was brought about by a budget note in either Board of Tax Practitioners or Accountancy budget report. And it requested the audit committee to look at the feasibility of combining the back office operations of the two. Not the boards themselves, but just the back office operations. Because of other legislative interests in back office operations of boards and small boards and commissions, the work was expanded by the audit committee. And the ultimate recommendation was it could be worthy of legislative review or consideration, but that if an undertaking of that size with those implications, combining the back office operations were to be begun, they suggested it be done in a very thorough fashion with either a interim task force specifically targeted towards that in an efficiency type of operation or through the session, but a targeted review to bring in the different stakeholders, because each of the boards that responded, how should I say this politely, is protective of its own turf and views itself differently, although many of us see commonality of back office operations. There are certain functions. Licensing is a function. What, you know, different criteria will apply as to what you need to have to attain that license. But there are models in other states where the back office operations are supported centrally for any number of different boards and commissions. That's a long-winded answer.
I would just share with the committee that I have the privilege of sitting on the Dornbecker board, and OHSU was served by two boards, both Dornbecker and the OHSU Foundation. This is a foundation that manages in excess of $100 million in assets and has a great number of donors. It's a pretty complex operation. And they operated as two completely autonomous boards and ended up melding the back rooms. And so they still retain their own identity, and if a person wants to make a contribution to Dornbecker, they come through the front door of what appears to be Dornbecker, but it's a completely combined back room. So gift acknowledgments and all of the back room stuff is done in a single place by a single staff. And they found considerable savings in doing that. I guess in a highly constrained budget environment, I'm just not willing to accept turf protection as a good enough reason not to seriously explore any savings that could be realized by a combined back room. And what I'm going to ask the professional staff to do is to make sure that we all have a refreshed copy of the document. If you can send it electronically, that's fine, and if it needs to be delivered, that's fine. But for phase two of the Ways and Means process, I would ask the committee to take a look at that with an eye towards any savings that could be achieved by a combined back room while maintaining the public identity of the two, the Board of Tax Practitioners and the Board of Accountancy, but to see if there's any savings. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I'll second what you're suggesting. And while I don't have a dog in this fight, and I'll follow your lead, I would point out that we're only dealing with 7 FTE on the Board of Accountancy, and I'd have a difficult time doing a interim study if we're going to do it. Let's do it.
Well, I think certainly this is the beginning of this iteration of the subcommittee's exploration of this issue. I know it's something that former Chair Butler explored at some length, and I believe that any of the committee would be willing to hear additional input from either the CPAs or the Board of Tax Practitioners as to why this would be good and efficacious or why this would be bad. And so I invite that information to come forward to the committee, but I also am going to flag this as something that we would seriously look at in the second phase and to put the Board of Tax Practitioners on notice that this is something that we'll want to chat with them about as well when their hearing comes. Please.
In phase two, with the committee's indulgence, we'll try to schedule the phase two hearings for these two boards after April 15th. Both, that's why they're you may not see the board chair sitting here because it's tax season. And we will have the benefit of the Board of Tax Practitioners chair because that chair is located right here in Salem and can break away for an hour or two.
Out earning a living. What a novel concept.
So that way you would have some input from the members of the board themselves.
Great. And that would be very useful. And I think all the members of the board, of the panel here, invite additional information. But it's something that I think that we'd like to discuss. Thank you for letting me interrupt your flow of your presentation. Please continue.
Thank you. My flow is never a problem to interrupt or get back into. I think we were just completing the administrative portion of our activities, and I mentioned that includes the board meetings that are scheduled and the meetings of its five standing committees. The board also appoints advisory committees from time to time to focus on specific professional issues so that they have opinions and discussions from different areas of the profession. And all of these groups make recommendations to the committee regarding whatever topic they have been requested to consider. The committees and the task forces are composed of volunteer licensees. They provide for us technical expertise that is not readily available on the board staff. And while the board itself continues to be the decision-making authority in all matters, it places a great deal of reliance and importance on the recommendations that come to it from its committees and advisory groups. The board has a number of target groups that we work with. The Board of Accountancy serves a diverse group of customers and stakeholders, all of whom share an interest in the fair, consistent, and safe administration of the practice of public accountancy in Oregon. First of all, there are the direct consumers of public accounting services, folks like you and like me who want assistance in the preparation of their taxes, either for their individual business or for their business interests. The same individuals may require bookkeeping or accounting services. Governmental entities and publicly owned companies are often required to be audited, and these are services that may only be provided by a licensed accountant. And businesses that are seeking various business licenses are also often required to provide some sort of a reviewed financial statement before a license will be granted to them. A second group of individuals that are among our target groups is a group that is known in the industry as third reliance groups, third reliance parties. And these are folks who are not necessarily direct consumers of the services provided by certified public accountants and public accountants, but they are nevertheless folks who rely on the work that is presented. And they, the most obvious of these, and the ones you are the most familiar with, of course, are individuals, investment managers, retirement groups, who rely on reports, audited financial statements of investment companies before they make investments in private or public vehicles. There are also state and local government agencies that are affected by or that require public accounting services. There are audit requirements of municipal corporations, of local governments, and many state agencies require auditing of or review of their licensees. Financial institutions and other businesses that extend credit to businesses or individuals may also wish to have an independent accountant take a look at their books and records before they extend the loan, so that they have some assurance that this is a business that is going to be there 3 months down the line or 6 months down the line before they extend credit. These are all people who are not direct consumers of the services, but they are the ones who make the requirement. They're the ones who say, this is what I want before I'm going to give you this loan. And then it's the customer's obligation to go and retain a licensed accountant to provide whatever service has been required. Finally, it is also very common for businesses who are considering contracts or alliances with other businesses to also want some assurance from an independent accountant with financial acumen to give an opinion before they enter into this contract or before they enter into a partnership with someone that they've been working with across the street for many years, but they've never been in the back room, so to speak, to make sure that really this business is being run in the manner that they would expect a business to be run. Finally, there are others that are target groups of the Board of Accountancy. They include federal regulatory bodies and professional organizations that promulgate standards for the practice of public accountancy. These include, for example, the General Accounting Office, that promulgates the standards for governmental audits. Independent Standards Board, which is most recently being created under the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, which has developed standards for the financial statements of publicly registered companies. We, of course, are all familiar with the Securities and Exchange Commission and the requirements they have for accounting services. There is another new regulatory organization, fondly known among its regulated as Peekaboo. It is the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, PCAOB, and it is an oversight board that particularly looks at the public accounting firms that provide financial services and review of financial statements for those companies that are registered on the stock exchange. And these are all a result of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, and which are, of course, a result of the last 5 years of audit failures that you have been reading about in the newspaper and wish that we hadn't been reading about. That's one group.
May I?
Please.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know enough about this to ask intelligent questions, I'm sorry, but are you talking about Oregon companies who are on the exchange? Is that what you're talking about, limited to Oregon?
Madam Chair. And Senator Marsette, yes, it certainly may include Oregon companies that are on exchange, but
broader than that.
But if you think about firms, let's think about the big four now. We've come down from 8 to 6 to 5 to 4. At any rate, there are four, perhaps, of the largest firms, KPMG, Deloitte Touche, used to be Arthur Andersen, Pricewaterhouse. These firms operate across the country. And so they provide these services for publicly registered companies, even though the company may not be in Oregon. But there may be Oregon licensees who assist with those financial statements. So it is a concern that crosses all state licensing jurisdictions, whether or not it's going on in our state. Because the standards to which all of these licensed accountants must adhere are national standards. They cross state lines. If I am an Oregon licensee and I'm performing a financial audit, I have to do it according to the same standards that the person in Connecticut must follow when he's doing them. And so if there are licensees in Oregon or firms in Oregon who are performing financial services for a publicly owned company, then they must adhere to the federal regulation as well as Oregon's regulations. But these things I'm talking about all go to federal regulation that may very well affect Oregon licensees as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Among the other stakeholders or targets of our board are state regulatory agencies that are affected by the practice of Oregon licensees. These would be other licensing bodies, for example, other groups, other agencies that license businesses to provide services or products to the public, and they too want some affirmation before they issue the license that this business is not a fly-by-night that's going to take the public's money and then be gone in 6 months. And so they may have requirements as well for some level of review of the financial statements of these organizations before they will issue a license. This would include, for example, the insurance agency, the securities division, before they issue a broker-dealer's license. They want to make sure that this business is not a sham business before they're allowed to take money from the public. Madam.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. So walk me through really quick. If I wanted information on a CPA firm and I'm a consumer, would I just make a call, provide the name of the company, and then what would I be able to receive?
Remain, ma'am.
Please.
Representative Smith. It's very simple. There are several things you can do, each taking you a step closer. The first thing you could do is go on the Internet and check our licensing database and find out if the individual or the firm is, in fact, registered or licensed in Oregon. That database would give you a certain amount of information. I'm sure it would not tell you everything you wanted to know. So you could then follow that up with a call to our office, and then we could provide
more detailed information. You might want to know how long this firm has been in business in Oregon. And we could say 6 months, or we could say 22 years. And your decision may vary depending on that answer. You may want to know, well, 22 years, that's a long time. You know, have they ever been in trouble? And so we would be able to look at our complaint, that individual's complaint file, and tell you whether there have been disciplinary actions taken against them. We do not tally complaints that are filed that do not result in disciplinary action under the theory that anybody can file a suit. It may not have merit. And so if we find that complaints are filed, we investigate them, we find no violation, that won't be in the information that's available on our database. But complaints that result in disciplinary sanctions of any sort will be included. So you may get that information from us. If you want more information than what we can tell you on the telephone, you may make a public records request. You may want to come in and look at the licensing file and find out, you know, who are the individuals. We could read this to you over the phone if you wanted, but you may want to satisfy your curiosity by coming to the office if you're nearby. You may want to look through an investigation file and find out what was ferreted out during this investigation, if it seems to be a problem that relates to your interest. And this goes to the public request question that we had earlier. Our Oregon is an open record state. There is very little that is not available to public disclosure. And so with an appropriate request and within a reasonable time, the board responds to all requests for public information.
Follow-up.
Thank you. quite a few nonprofits and local government special districts request annual audits be conducted. I'm curious, how often do you get phone calls from nonprofits or from local governments calling up just to do background checks on the auditors that are also licensed CPAs?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, not nearly often enough. First of all, the requirement for a municipality to have an audit comes through the Division of Audits. Nonprofits do not call on that same requirement. Their requirement is not by state law.
Right.
And so they may have other reasons. Their benefactors, sure, you know, may require that. And generally, a nonprofit, if it's small, is usually not composed of individuals who have a great deal of sophistication about these matters. And so we have very few calls from those people. We do provide to the municipal corporations a list of municipal auditors. And in order to perform audits for municipal corporations under that law, you have to be a municipal auditor licensed with us. So we provide those people once a year with a list of the licensed auditors who may perform services for corporations. Nonprofits, not so. We don't even know who they all are. But that's an interesting area. That would be a good area for us to put on our outreach via our website for information. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think it's an important point.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to exercise the prerogative of the chair and ask that we move along. It's 10 minutes after 9. We have you only scheduled for one day, and we're only on page 2.
And I was complaining because it would only take me 30 minutes to get through this.
Right. Well, you missed that mark. So.
All right. May I assume that you don't have a great deal of interest in our org chart? We are 7 FTEs, a board of 7 members appointed by the governor. This is attached to A in your book. The board members must be, of course, confirmed by the Senate. I am hired and evaluated by the board. I have a staff of 6 FTE. Among our small agency, there is a great crossover of responsibilities. So while there are some responsibilities listed on this org chart, it does not begin to say the crossover that goes on. We are very fortunate. We have an excellent staff, and we have had a fairly stable staff over the years. So I
wouldn't characterize it as we're not interested. We just would like to make sure we get through the material.
I understand.
Thank
well,
you.
I didn't mean to cast any such judgment. The next area of discussion then is performance measures. And you'll find the documents on our performance measures at Attachment B. The Board of Accountancy has no links to the Oregon benchmarks. However, high-level outcomes identified by the Board are consistent with the high-level outcomes for state government that have been identified by the Governor and by the Oregon Progress Board.
Why is it that you have no links to the Oregon Progress?
It's a benchmark.
Our benchmark, sorry.
Madam Chair, you know, we just don't do anything that supports the benchmarks. They are a much higher level than what a regulatory licensing agency does. 6 years ago, when we were still trying to identify, and most of us identified education, we can certainly say we have a link to the education benchmark because we have this continuing education requirement, and so sure, that's good. However, we were advised that that wasn't really what the governor was getting at or what the state was getting at in his education benchmark. And you know, I always felt like I could say that the Board of Accountancy had a primary role in economic development of this state and the development of businesses, because I think businesses are very dependent and reliant on the services that certified public accountants and public accountants provide for them and the availability of these licensees to provide this professional service. But that was also not one that was deemed to be a close enough touch.
Thank you.
To do that. And I apologize that I can't say that we do have, but our high-level outcomes include public protection, customer service, and providing regulation that supports a positive business environment.
Mr. Wynan.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I was just going to add that in the past there was a driving force that insisted if you didn't have a link to the Oregon benchmarks, you didn't have a reason to exist in government. Well, that didn't prove to be the case, and so people were finding links to benchmarks that were somewhat tenuous. So in the recent years, particularly with the formalization of key performance measures through this process, they've tried to focus on the mission of the organization as it exists either in statute or in constitutions, and those that did link up directly to the benchmarks that they've identified, and those that didn't, they felt still had a reason to exist.
Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you. Under the first high-level outcome of public protection, each of our five performance measures, our five key performance measures that you have in your book, contribute to the board's mission of safeguarding public protection. Performance measure one, if you move along until you come to these really nice little charts that Papa's board put together for us, all we have to do is punch in the numbers and we come up with these pretty little pictures. Performance measure one goes to the number of website hits to consumer-related sites on our website. And it measures our public access and availability of consumer-related information. We anticipate an increase in the volume of website access as the board continues to expand and identify information that is of value, exactly as the topic that Representative Smith just suggested to me.
Could I ask you to nuance this slightly more? What you're doing is telling us that 44,000 people accessed your website. And I guess I'm trying to correlate that to how well does that measure how you're doing?
Madam Chair, it's telling us that 44,000 people accessed those pages that we deem to be consumer-related. And so we have certain pages that we're calling here. Our total hits to the website were higher than this. It is a difficult measurement because each person who hits the website may hit on a number of pages, so those numbers are never going to be able to be linked up. I don't think that it is telling us so much how well we are doing overall, but it is telling us that we are increasing the availability and the interest of the public in information that is important for public protection. The board feels very strongly that an educated or an aware public is going to be better protected than one that has no awareness. And so as the things that we can do to increase that knowledge for members of the public through our website, which is the most accessible manner, we feel are contributing to the goals of the board.
Thank you.
Performance measure two provides information regarding licensee compliance with continuing education requirements. Continuing education, as I mentioned earlier, is one of the board's primary ways to ensure that competency is continued upon renewal. And the board gauges this compliance by performing an annual audit of the continuing education reports that are submitted with licensee renewals. This audit has been conducted for more than 20 years. However, the statistics weren't gathered. And so when the performance measures began, the statistics were being calculated in a way that was not providing reliable information for the board. And it took us a year or two to figure this out.
If I come in for relicensing, do I have to demonstrate that I have fulfilled a continuing education?
Yes, Senator, you do.
Each time I relicense?
Yes, biannually. That's every other year.
Then how come if continuing education is a condition of relicensing, how come your percentage is 79%? Wouldn't it be 100%? I'm not going to get relicensed if I haven't done my continuing education.
Yes. An excellent question, and that's exactly what our data was showing us before. It was showing 100% because eventually everyone comes into compliance in the audit. But we didn't feel that was telling the board exactly how our licensees were performing. For example, if a the audit says, show me the proof that you did what you said you did, and the proof is in some certificates of completion or information, some evidence that they did attend this course, and also a demonstration that the course itself contributes to your professional competency. So we send out a letter and it says, show me the proof. And they all send back their proof. And their proof may not be within the requirements or the standards of the board. If it is not, we send them a letter, 21 days, and fix this. So there's a period of time in which they're allowed to come into compliance. And under the earlier calculation, in the end, everyone is brought into compliance. And so we were calling it 100%. And then I thought, this is not really reliable, because everyone isn't at 100% at the first letter that they receive, at their first response back to the board. And that should be our gauge, because that is telling us how many are in truth in compliance with requirements at the time of renewal, and not when they've been given these little footholds to come into compliance. And so our new method of calculating it is going to show not nearly as nice a numbers.
Senator Morsette.
I really appreciate that, because the problem with performance measures is the difference between quantity and quality, and what you're getting at is the quality part of it. And I think that's what we really need in performance measures, is quality.
Thank you, Senator, and it's exactly what the board needs.
Yeah, I think that's
because
great.
The board was under the mistaken impression that everyone was walking through the door carrying the golden egg, and in fact they weren't until they were given opportunities to prove that. For example, then, if you'll see on the target, we've removed the target. In the early years, there was no target. And then around 2000 or whenever this began, we were showing 100%, and those have been removed. We had to request to modify this performance measure during this session so that we could show the calculations differently. So when we did the modification, we took an arbitrary figure for our target for 2003. We simply took 50%, not knowing where that was going to be on the board. And then, as it turned out, in 2003, we had 73% compliance. I thought 73% didn't look bad, since it was better than what we thought the median would be. The board members don't think 73% is that good. They think it should be much higher. So then we built our targets for the ensuing years based on that 73%, setting 2004 at 73, and then I believe it's a 1% increase for each year thereafter. Our audit of this function has not been completed yet for 2004, so I don't know where we're going to be. And there's another aspect of this that has changed, that figures in. Licensees who can't show the CPE, the continuing education requirements, may choose to go inactive. If they do that, they're giving up their public practice, if they're involved in public practice. But oftentimes they're not. Oftentimes they're working in a position that doesn't require an active license, and so they really didn't need to do this. So some of them may drop off by going inactive. If they absolutely cannot meet the requirements and make no effort to do so, then the board also has the authority to suspend that license until they do meet the requirements.
Representative Smith, how long can you remain inactive before you lose your license?
Madam Chair, there is no time limit. You renew every 2 years.
If I'd been out of the process for 20 years, what would it take for me to reactivate my license
in terms of
continuing education?
Yes, then you're in what we call the reinstatement process. And anything over 5 years requires 160 hours of continuing education, which has to have been taken within the 2 years immediately prior to the reinstatement time, and a payment of the license fee is all.
continuing education from some accredited source or something the board deems appropriate? Because you've just said that some of your folks were taking continuing education that your board doesn't recognize as acceptable.
Yes, Madam Chair. There are, I keep seeing that quote, and I keep thinking that Representative Bakke's hand is up. Excuse me, for I'm nope. always seeing that out of front of my eye.
It may come up, depending on what you say, but not yet.
Thank you. There are different levels. For example, the Oregon ethics requirement must be provided by an Oregon registered sponsor, and those sponsors have a list of topics that they must include in their ethics program. The only other eligibility requirement, so to speak, for continuing education is what is called independent study, and those are like courses that you send away for, and you do them on your own, you take a test. And around 1997 or 98, there was so much lack of uniformity among these independent classes. There was no way for boards across the country to be able to judge the quality of each one, and they were looking for a way to do that. And so they came up with a solution of a quality assurance program that is run by the National Association of State Boards of Accountancy. And they review these independent study courses and qualify them under certain standards. And so at this point, Oregon licensees who wish to do independent study may only receive credit for it if it is provided by a quality assurance approved provider. Those are the only approvals that we have of continuing education, other than the fact that programs have to meet certain standards to be eligible at all.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, please continue.
Okay, the third performance measure establishes a time frame of 6 months from a date a complaint is received until it is referred to the complaints committee, and that is our definition of the time period to be processed within 6 months. And this is another area that has been tracked and calculated by the board over the years but didn't become a performance measure. As you can see, there's been an up and down in the ability to meet this, to increase the goal of the number, the percentage of complaints that are processed within the six-month period. That has been for various reasons. In 1997, the board obtained authority to hire another FTE who would be an investigator so that we could meet our obligation in a more timely fashion. And there have been points where that investigator has changed and we've not had a position. So for lack of resources, sometimes it has gone down. Another factor that weighs in here very highly is the presence of very complex investigation complaints for which we don't have the expertise on staff, even though we have an investigator. And so at this point, the board has decided to use personal service contracts to hire professional consultants to handle those cases that are outside of the realm of expertise of our staff and to be able to move those off. This then allows our staff to focus on the matters that are more within our ability.
So you're anticipating you're going to have a lot of these complex cases in 2006 and 2007? Is that, I mean, to jump, to go from 100% down to 71 is startling.
No, Madam Chair, that's a matter of expectations that were probably too high when we were required to set the target for 2004 and 2005 and 2006 or whatever those years are. I can't tell. That was a matter of thinking, this is terrific, we're going to get up to 100%. In fact, those are unrealistic goals. We're never going to have 90%, simply because of the time frames that are required and because there are too many factors outside of the board's control. Receipt of documents from the parties, cooperation of the parties is something that is not within our control, and it will definitely affect the time frame. And so what we've done is we've brought it down to what we consider to be a more realistic. We were advised by the progress board, we can't be changing our targets all the time. Once we've set them there, we need to leave them there and then be able to explain why they were set at too high a number. So I'm hoping that this less than 80%, 76 or whatever it is, 71 and 72% in 6 and 7 are more realistic targets. I had an additional piece of paper for you that shows our complaints history. There we go. If you are interested in looking at that. It is one that is landscape, and oops, that's not it. I found it, thank you. Looks like this. You all found it before I did. This gives you an idea of the sort of cases that we've looked at since 1999, the numbers, and those that are processed administratively, and the results that have come from them. The bottom line is that between 1998 and 2004, the board has processed 581 complaints, and of those, 56% overall have been processed within 6 months. That's an average of the numbers in the last column. But you can see in the last column that the board has been doing progressively better in meeting the six-month goal. For 2004, which is not reflected on your little key chart over here, we were able to complete 73% of the complaints that we were processing, both administratively and otherwise, within the six-month period. So we believe that we are doing a better job in achieving that goal. And you can see the results. There are some results in civil penalties, some in no jurisdiction, some are revokes or suspends.
No jurisdiction, I presume no jurisdiction of the board?
That's right.
Why would you have no jurisdiction over a licensee?
Depending on what the question is, if it goes to a matter that is outside of the board's regulation, I don't like the way this person dressed when he came. I don't like the way this person didn't respond to my phone calls. That's not something we regulate. I don't like the fee that I was charged. We don't regulate fees. That's outside of our board jurisdiction. And in fact, fee disputes are very frequently a complaint that comes particularly after tax season.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. Can you explain on this little chart here, mm-hmm. how come address changes is a category measured under disciplinary action?
Why is that a disciplinary action?
It's an address change.
It's a violation. Licensees are required to provide notice of their address change within 30 days. If they do not, it's a violation of a rule. And so when we learn of that, we bring an action against them for a $100 civil penalty for failure to provide address change.
I guess I want to bore in on that a little bit further. It's a $100 civil penalty for failing to notify you that their address changed, but you're not engaged in any fee disputes. And it seems to me that as far as customer satisfaction and making sure that the profession is behaving professionally, fee disputes would be an area where the board might want to exercise some influence. Why is it that you don't weigh in there, but you charge somebody $100 not to tell you their address?
Madam Chair, the address change is an important regulation because we have to be able to locate a licensee to provide them with information at any time. And so we need to have their current address. It is not our responsibility to go searching them out. So that is an important aspect of our regulatory authority. As to the fee dispute, there is a situation where a fee dispute will be reviewed by the board and investigation conducted. For example, if a licensee receives continuous complaints about fee disputes, the board will think if there's that much smoke, there must be something behind it. And so we'll look into it, because a fee dispute may simply be an indication of a misconduct matter. And we have a recent case that I may use as an example, if you wish.
Sure.
There were 9 or 10 complaints about a licensee, and they all related to fee dispute. What it came down to was this individual would quote a certain fee and have the licensees sign an engagement letter, and the engagement letter said, should we have any disputes over our fees, we'll submit them to arbitration. But and invariably, the matter required greater hours, greater time than had been initially estimated, and the people didn't understand that. But they might have understood that better, except that instead of submitting their matters to arbitration, the licensee was submitting them to a collection agency immediately. And the collection agency, of course, then was pounding on penalties and interest and threatening, damage to their credit reputation. And, in fact, one individual had said, wait a minute here, I want to go to arbitration, and had been denied the opportunity. And so the board did take action against this individual because it was not just a fee dispute. It was the conduct and the breach of a contract with his clients that was at issue here, and this is a matter of professional misconduct. So there are situations when a fee dispute will rise or will go beyond simply a matter of setting fees.
Representative Smith.
How often are CPAs represented by legal counsel in these type of situations? And do you have, without knowing the internal operation, do you have the expertise internally to deal with someone who brings forward legal counsel?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I suppose it depends on how serious, how high the proposed penalty and how serious they deem the potential damage before they get an attorney. Most often, after the investigation progresses, they will get an attorney if they haven't in the beginning. And we as an agency use the Department of Justice and the Attorney General's Office for our counsel, our legal counsel. However, we conduct our investigations generally without the assistance of legal counsel, other than perhaps a question that arises that we're unsure of the legal response to it. When it comes to the point where the board issues a notice of proposed action, at that point, most folks will obtain an attorney.
Would it be possible, purely for my own interest, just to find out what the Board of Accountancy spent working with the AG's office?
Certainly.
On these issues?
Certainly. I can't give you that number.
No,
at the moment,
I know you can.
But I can tell you what our AG fees were, for example, in the last biennium.
And the number of hours.
The number of hours. I'll have to ask the AG's office. They can provide that.
Thank you.
I can give you the dollars without a problem.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Vafia.
It looks like in 2004 your board completed twice to three times as many complaints as it had in previous years. And I'm curious what was going on within your board that allowed you to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Vakian. That is partly administrative. It is at this point that the board had decided to become more serious about those people who had violated the CPE audit and to bring notice against them rather than continue with these little hand-holding letters that say you have this much time, you have this much time. Instead, we say, unless you provide this within 21 days, we are going to issue a notice of license suspension against you, or you may go inactive. Take your pick. And so many of those are brought in through the CPE audit, which is an administrative function. And another is renewal of firms. In the past, if a firm did not renew, we didn't follow up to find out if it was an oversight or if they chose to terminate. They're supposed to advise us if they wish to terminate. So if they don't advise us, we assume they're still out there doing business. And so those who did not renew in the appropriate time fashion, we followed up to find out, are they still doing business? Was it an oversight? Or, you know, do they not intend to renew? And those who had not renewed and were continuing to do business, we also brought an action against those. So you have in this number of 63, no, process 51 on 2004, that line?
Well, I'm sorry, I was looking at under total complaints. I assumed that that was total complaints that you completed and that there was some kind of a backlog, which might have been one of the reasons for you getting up to 150.
True, but it also includes additional files processed administratively. Under that third column, you'll see the number 51.
Mm-hmm.
And that number is expanded because of the CPE audits, because of firm registration renewals, rather than allowing them to simply register late with no penalty. The board is taking action to make sure that that doesn't continue.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead, please.
Performance measure 4, and I also have a piece of paper that I provided for you today that is a copy of a customer renewal survey. So it's in the two or three or four pieces of paper that Dallas gave you. This is a performance measure that measures our customer service with regard to the annual renewal process. We renew licenses every year, but we only renew half of our licenses every year. It's a biennial renewal. And so each year we handle about 3,600 licensee renewals. This is a service that ultimately affects every licensee, and it can be measured on an annual basis because the service is occurring every year. Results from the 2004 renewal survey have not been included in the information that you have in front of you. However, we have collected that data, and I am very happy to say that the results for 2004 are exactly the target that we had expected. We achieved 90% of those people responding to the overall question, overall quality of services provided, as good or excellent.
So how many people respond? If you're doing half your licensees and you've got almost 8,000 licensees, that means 4,000 in any cycle. How many responses did you get back?
In this particular year, we received 427 responses.
400 out of 4,000?
About 3,600.
Okay.
And of the 427, only, if you'll see on your on the survey, the bottom line is overall rating. Not everyone filled that in. And so of the ones that are cataloged here are only the ones who filled in the overall rating. And they were about 350. And I was not able to find an empty sample, I apologize. But I had to pick out one that looked like it was pretty good so that you'd be impressed.
I'm sure.
Representative.
I do appreciate that. The comment, actually, at the bottom of this one, talking about asking the opportunity to do this online, is that something you're moving to as part of your overall streamlining?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Brett. In looking at them last night when I was trying to find one that looked good for you, the ones that I was paging through, almost every one of them made that request.
Really?
Or made that comment. Our licensees are very interested in being able to do things interactively online. And I'm finding in my experience in this position that certified public accountants are a very sophisticated group with regard to internet technology, and they wish to become more so. We are working toward that goal. We are trying to figure out ways that it can be done efficiently as well as easily, and that it will affect cost savings. Right now, we haven't been able to see that, and we're not technologically ready to
close
do that.
Enough. We know
Thanks.
What you meant.
Thanks. Thanks for letting me off the hook.
Madam Chair, just a quick question.
Representative Smith.
I process information a little slowly. Back on a previous performance measure, you made the analogy where there's smoke, there could be fire. Wouldn't that apply to your licensees who fail to turn in their documentation, that perhaps they're not also taking care of their clients in an appropriate manner? The CPAs I work with, my goodness, everything's boom, 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 boom. And if they can't get their own paperwork in, I would think that smoke was something else.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, you're absolutely right. And, in fact, you are echoing the comments of our board members when they see these. They have very little tolerance for their own members who can't follow the rules, particularly the continuing education rules, because they see those as constant. They themselves are always aware of them. They know what's required, and they've got it when the time comes, and they have no tolerance for anyone who doesn't.
Well, it's the nature of the industry to meet your timelines.
Absolutely. And your comment that if they can't keep their own house in order, how can they be expected to be doing a good job for others? And so that is the reason for the audit, and to force them either to go inactive or to be suspended until they do get their house in order. We have had, through the audit, situations come up where an individual reported 80 hours, which is the requirement. Beautiful, you know, perfect, no problem at all. And then in the audit, he couldn't provide us with any of the documentation. Well, it turns out he hadn't attended any of the classes. You know, it was a total sham. This person was revoked.
Thank you.
Okay, please continue. We're on.
Okay, let's go to performance measure 5.
10.
Well, I'm going to move on to page 13.
Okay, that's fine.
If you don't mind. This is a very easy performance measure to discuss. This is our indicator of our ability to regulate in a manner that encourages and promotes a supportive business climate. In this regard, the board reviews its administrative rules every year on an annual basis to determine whether the rules are clear, whether they're necessary, whether they factually state what is the requirement and what is intended. The annual rule review includes recommendations from each of the standing committees, from interested professional organizations, and from advisory committees when appropriate. The board has achieved this goal since January of 1999, and so, you know, we have 100% compliance with this one, and we'll continue to do so because it is totally within our control.
As a result of your annual review, have you ever changed any of your admin rules? Because what this seems to measure is, do you look at them? It doesn't seem to measure, do you find any of them that are wanting or in need of change?
Madam Chair, I wish I could say no, but every year the changes are, many of them have come from clarification, writing them in a way that states it more clearly. Many of them have been changed for substantive reasons. Yes, there are changes each year.
Else?
To follow on, if I may, Madam Chair, this measures an activity and not an outcome or an output. I just had to verbalize that because everything else measures an outcome or an output or something, so this just tracks the activity. And I've got a note that in phase two we need to look at, you know, that's part of phase two is to review performance measures. And I, as your staff, would recommend this one up for consideration.
I think I'm seeing heads nod along the panel, so let's flag this one to come back to.
Well, may I?
Representatives, yeah. I mean, Senator Morissette. Okay.
But there is some, you do change the rules, right?
Yes.
So there is, in a sense, a quality involved in this, I think, that no one complains, or, well, everyone responds positively. Or are you measuring non-response or obviously a non-response?
Chair Johnson, Senator Morissette, there's no response from licensees as to our administrative rules after they're completed, other than the fact that we believe they are available in its clear and concise.
But what does this measure?
It measures, I think, as you stated, the quality of the rules and the information that we have available for licensee, the timeliness of it, and that it is not obsolete or, you know, dust covered. The board is looking at it. They're viable versions of our rules.
Follow up.
Then you think it is a quality issue rather than just an activity?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, yes, that's how we have viewed it.
Okay, well, we'll have this.
Yeah, I would respectfully disagree, and I think it's something we're going to revisit because it says, did you look at your rules?
Yeah.
Yes. And the goal is, did we look at our rules? And it's easy to achieve 100% as long as you looked at them. The question is, when you looked at them, what happened? And that's the piece that's missing for me.
I would suggest you go down to 99 just one time, and then we can go back.
There you go, and then we can applaud you on what you did. Okay, let's move ahead.
I can talk more about performance measures, unless you've heard all you wish.
Help us. That appeared to be number five, the only one that we had. What more would you add? Or are we missing pages?
There was some interest in seeing how performance measures assisted in agency management and budgeting decisions. And so I have a little discussion about that.
Why don't you go ahead and offer us that?
Statistics indicated to us that investigations were not being processed as promptly as desired. And this prompted the board to authorize personal service contracts, as I mentioned before, with professional consultants to investigate complex investigations and free up staff to do those more mundane investigations.
In phase two, I'd like very much to know how that consultant list is developed, how frequently it's refreshed, what effort is made to make sure that the pool is wide. I know Representative Smith has spent a great deal of energy this session looking at minority, small, and emerging businesses and them having access to be able to provide that professional consulting assistance. And so if you could give us a list of the consultants you use and how often that consultant pool is refreshed, that would be great.
And, Madam Chair,
Representative Vlachin.
Since we have another somewhat related board in the back of the room, I'd be curious, too, about consultants that are being used by other boards and whether they're using the same consultants covering the same general areas.
Great. I think
that's a heads up.
I think that's a good heads up. We'll be probing on that one. Okay.
The performance measures also indicated to the board very positive results in our website development support and encouraged the board to continue putting resources into website development and information technology.
What efforts are you making to standardize your website in terms of appearance and content with other state websites? I know there's an initiative to try to have them be similar in format and ease of accessing.
Yes, Chair Johnson. It is true, and our board is I don't know what percentage we are to completion. My staff member who does that told me the other day that she's ready to move ours over. We've been running two websites for a while because in the process of development, our old website, which wasn't so old, and the new website. And she said she's ready to move over, so we just have the new website. So I would say we're 99% complete with that transition to the new Oregon website.
Thank you. And who's doing your website development? Is that something that's contracted out, or is that an IRMD DAS employee?
Chair Johnson, Representative Kraft, in this instance, we were using Representative Jim Hill's agency's assistance for this transition. Some of the background work was provided to us by computer consultants that we hire for our computer support, but for the most part, that assistance has been provided through IRMD.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And as I mentioned, it was the data that we were collecting from on the continuing education performance measure that indicated to the board that this was not a reliable form of information, and therefore they wanted more accurate information. Overall, our results have provided fairly positive responses. Nevertheless, the board is aware of the fact that not all of its performance measures are totally within its control, and they're also looking for different opportunities to measure customer surveys. The basic one that we're using right now is the renewal form that you looked at, but there are other ways, and we're in the process of developing, for example, one for exam candidates. Particularly since we have a new computer-based exam, we want to be able to see how exam candidates are working through that process. And we're also looking at a customer survey for complaints that are registered and how the process worked for them. So we're looking at more opportunities to do that. I think that's all I have to say on that matter.
Great.
Board priorities is the next topic that we've been asked to discuss. And at D and E, In your notebook are the spreadsheets that we prepared for this. The board has categorized its activities into three areas of priority. These are the same areas that I discussed with you earlier. The first one, of course, is a licensing function. The second is compliance and enforcement, and the third is board support. The licensing function, I've already stated, includes the exam and the initial licensing programs. Proposed reductions in the area of exam and licensing include the elimination of printed publications that we provide to exam candidates and to new licensees at no cost.
Madam Chair?
Representative Vivek.
We skipped over attachment C, which I wanted to ask one question.
Very well.
The balances, I think a number of us would like to ask that. I didn't want to disrupt the flow of the presentation, but let's
I'm
go
happy
back to
wait
it.
If you'd like.
It sort of fits in anywhere. I'd be happy to discuss it
right now. Let's do it right now.
If you could, let's pick the 2003-05. You have a beginning balance of 704 and then projected revenue of 1.6. Your ending balance ends up being about 45,000 more. So explain to me what your beginning balance and your ending balance really represents. And then if you could, what happens to that ending balance in the first quarter after this biennium ends? Did you follow me?
Chair Johnson, I'll ask along the way. If I haven't, you can clarify. Thank you. And Representative Vakian, first of all, this chart is based on the legislative approved budgets. And so for 9901, 0103, they're actual numbers. 0305, they're proposed numbers. So the ending balance here of $749,000 is based on a proposed revenue or a projected revenue, which is a mark I don't expect we're going to hit. The reason for that is because that revenue was based on the old exam, the paper and pencil exam, which brought more revenue into the board's office than the new exam does. And so our revenue numbers are going to be down. That, of course, is going to affect the ending balance. Our expenditures will also be down somewhat because our expenditures related to both exams goes down in the same way, but not in the same proportion. So I believe that our ending balance at the end of 05 is going to be closer to $600,000 in looking at real numbers rather than this proposed one. So in response to your question about the first quarter after, that's where I think you're going to see the true numbers of our ending balance. And I think it's going to be in that neighborhood.
You're anticipating.
The ending balance that you then carry over mm-hmm. is not an ending balance that is fully spent in the first quarter or second quarter. It appears that you've been able to, through careful planning, to create a bit of a buffer for yourself. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And that you're bringing in enough money in revenues that you can pay for your expenses throughout the biennium and continue to carry that buffer in order to protect yourself from a downturn. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair. Representative Bakken, that's correct.
Okay.
However, we do see it gradually decreasing.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. you made mention that your expenditures will be decreasing, but not at the same ratio as the revenue. I'm struggling with why your expenditures want to decrease significantly if you're going to an online or an e-system or online system rather than a paper. To me, it seems like the savings would be significant.
Chair Johnson and Representative Smith, the expenses of the paper and pencil exam included renting the fairgrounds twice a year and hiring proctors twice a year, and then regular office expense that we don't count toward, various rentals, would run probably at a high end $10,000 per year for two exams, five, probably a little higher than that, maybe around $12,000 for two exams during the year. So if you extrapolate that and be generous and say $30,000 for the biennium might be the expenditures. We're going to continue to have all of the office expenditures, the print, the publication, the FTE, mailing expenditures, those will continue. The ones that we no longer have are these rentals and the proctors. Those are the primary expenses that we will no longer be incurring for the computer exam.
Are you still going to need the paper?
Both the process of applications and the materials that we send to applicants, to candidates, that all relates to our rules and the rules of the exam. I'm not getting through.
Can I just really quick, I know time's of the essence. When someone takes an exam, though, isn't the exam on a computer screen?
Yes, sir.
So what happens to the physical book that you used to have to print where they circled the answer in the book? Isn't there a savings in printing cost?
Yes, you're right. I wasn't even thinking of the exam. We send documents out, we send copies of our rules to make sure the candidates understand what their eligibility requirements are.
Apples and apples, because that was done before. That's going to continue.
That's going to be done now, and that's what I was trying to say.
What I'm trying
is that
to
those kinds of expenses will continue.
Right. What I'm trying to figure out, though, is by moving to a computerized system versus the paper and pencil, mm-hmm. there's going to be services and supply expenses that you used to have that you no longer will have, and I'm trying to figure out why that isn't more significant than what you're sharing with us. To me, it seems like eliminating the printing cost and eliminating rentals would be a significant savings for your board.
Madam Chair, if I may jump
in.
Yeah,
help me here.
Yeah.
Would you please state your name for the record?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is Satish Upadhyay with the Department of Administrative Services. In the governor's budget, you will see a phase out of $147,000. That is in package 022, and we'll talk more about it in phase two. So there is a reduction as a result of the conversion from the paper pencil exam to the computerized exam.
And that's going to play through then, and we'll be able to see that. Or Dallas will be able to see that in the ending balance. A reduction in the ending balance?
Representative Smith, that is already included when we came up with the ending balance in the governor's budget. So what? In phase two, when we walk through the different packages, you will see this reduction identified.
Can I just ask one last question?
You bet.
I want to flip this issue now, rather than being antagonistically almost optimistic. Well, I wouldn't be optimistic. What happens if we had an Enron Arthur Andersen issue in the state of Oregon? You don't have a pittance to deal with that type of issue. Would you then end up coming before the E-Board for additional resources to take on a situation of that nature?
Please answer.
Sure. Madam Chair, representatives, that's why one thing you see in this agency is they have a more healthy ending balance than other agencies. So they have like around 11 months of ending balance. So if such a situation were to come, then they would, if their existing limitation is not enough, then they would have to come to the e-board.
Representative Avakian, were you in the queue?
Well, yes, thank you. Sorry. And I think you just indirectly answered what my question was, but for this current biennium, can you approximate your average monthly expense for me? I say you may have indirectly answered it because you said that's an 11-month ending balance. Is that a fair that I can use that as the gauge, that that's 11 months worth?
Yes, Representative Avakian, that is for the 05-07 governor's budget. They have around 11 months of ending balance.
That'll do then. Thanks.
You're sitting on a lot of cash. Representative Crupton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When's the last time you had a fee increase for your licensees?
Madam Chair, Representative Crupton. Discounting House Bill 5002, which will be considered this term, which is an establishment of a fee, the most recent fee increase was approved in 1999.
Is that it? Okay. All right, please continue. I think we're done with the discussion of the ending balance for right now. So we're back on your priorities in Attachment D.
And the reductions.
Okay, so move to E, which are the reductions.
Yeah, at the same time. Pretty much close to their point of discussion. proposed reductions in the area of licensing includes the elimination of printed publications that we currently provide to exam candidates and new licensees. The information is available on the witness website, and individuals can still access it without any cost. If they don't have access to a computer, of course, they can always request a paper copy from us. It also includes reduced participation in national conferences. This crosses over both between the first and second priorities. Information that's available to state boards through our active participation in the national conferences and the National Organization of State Boards of Accountancy affects the board's ability to make decisions that affect all of its activities. This is important information that continues historically on the board through continued participation in these conferences. And finally, the reduction would also cause delay in our development of ways that license can do business with the board over the Internet and maintaining reliable currency in our information technology resources. This will also affect our office efficiencies and our streamlining efforts. The second priority, which includes compliance and enforcement activities, proposals for reduction include reductions of funds that are available for committee and board meetings and for board investigations.
Could you divide those out, please? Of the $21,000, how much is goes to investigatory processes and how much goes to board travel?
Of proposed reductions?
Of the $21,000?
Yeah. I would say, I don't have the numbers with me exactly, but my recollection is that the investigative would have been just under $10,000 and $8,000 for board and the remaining $3,000 for committees.
And so the $8,000 is mileage, a stipend for the board, expenses, overnights?
All of those, yes.
And what occasions them to travel?
Two board meetings. And to these conferences, out-of-state travel for these conferences that I mentioned. There are two conferences per year. We're talking about, that was in the prior one. That was in our prior one under the licensing, a reduction of travel.
Okay, so we've got $10,000 in board participation at conferences and $8,000 in in-state travel reimbursement and lodging.
We also would consider a reduction of professional membership, journals and reference materials. This would mean that our staff would be less well informed, and there would be a greater potential for inaccuracies in the work that we perform. Finally, we would also try to enhance and expand the distribution of printed materials via the Internet and charging to receive copies of information that we currently provide at no cost. Failure to provide this information, you know, may again result in licensees who are less well informed in the possibility of erring in violations. Our third priority is board support, administrative functions, and the reductions that have been proposed for the administrative aspect include reduction in staff training, reduction in our information technology consulting services that help us to maintain and upgrade our systems as necessary, and once again, material that's provided to stakeholders and to licensees.
I guess I'm curious why you characterize this as board support rather than customer service, because it seems that you've got a lot of expenses associated with the board already, and reducing computer consultants might make your website less friendly or less accurate or less fast. Notices is, again, licensees and stakeholders. And staff training is customer service, I would assume. I'm just curious why you characterize the board support.
Madam Chair, I think you're correct. I think it is customer service. We were trying to distill our program activities into three primary areas that are the overarching areas, and we identified those as licensing, enforcement, and finally administrative. We didn't define a program as customer service. Rather, we defined that as one of our performance.
That's fine. I don't want to argue semantics about it. Senator Morissette.
Thank you. Another maybe naive question. How much do you get? Is this all fee-driven budget? This is a fee-driven budget, not a general fund budget. Right. So isn't it up to the board to decide whether or not they want to cut some of these programs? I mean, it's not the general fund they're dealing with. They're dealing with fees that support the activities of the people that they represent. So I guess that's my concern.
Thank you.
I'm wondering about that.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. For round two, may I have a breakdown of what in the past we have spent on exams versus what we're going to be spending now, just so I can see that difference.
Right. Dallas has made a note of it.
Thank you.
All right. Well, I think then this we're at the end of your presentation, are we not?
We are, Madam Chair.
Okay. Are there any other questions for Ms. Reeves or Satish? All right. For the benefit of Senator Morris, who was testifying at another hearing, we are going to be exploring in round two the policy question of whether or not there's an opportunity for some administrative savings in the consolidation of the Board of Tax Preparers and the Board of Accountancy. And then we have a number of little specific questions that will come up across different areas of the presentation.
May I just ask
Senator Morissette?
I'm still a little bit puzzled and concerned. Has the board addressed the cuts in terms of why are we cutting a fee-based budget in terms of their priorities? Is this a are you required to cut? You're not required to cut.
It is statutory.
It is statutory.
Right.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if I may, we have been required to identify those reductions. We've not been required to make those cuts in the past, but we've been required to identify areas of reduction.
I understood to identify, but not as far as making.
That's correct.
Okay.
That would be part two of this Ways and Means process and the committee's prioritization.
Okay. I guess I'm not used to the dealing with the kinds of agencies that are completely fee-driven. I mean, this is a new experience for me on Ways and Means, and it's interesting to...
I think your question was helpful just to remind us. So, any other questions for the panel? All right. Well, absent any other comments or questions, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5001, the Board of Accountancy. And we will be back here tomorrow morning at 8:30. And Dallas, do you have any comments about the schedule or any announcements for the committee?
Oh, briefly, tomorrow we'll have the Board of Tax Practitioners, which that's adjacent to this one, somewhat similar. They're viewed similar. They have a little different regulatory responsibilities. That concludes this week. Next week, we'll start off with the governor's office. Then I believe it's that'll be my last time here, at least until the treasurer's office comes up. And then there'll be we'll pass out the schedule with your binders this afternoon, so you'll see the schedule for next week. And then there'll be Government Standards and Practices Commission on Tuesday, and the Secretary of State then next week.
Do we have binders for the tax returns?
Yes, they'll be passed out this afternoon.
Okay,
perfect. So you can get that if you can wait.
Senator Morris.
It's just a procedural question. If there's a determination by this panel that, in fact, there are legitimate reasons to bring these two commissions into one, or two functions into one, can we do that by way of a policy bill, or do we have to run through a different venue to do that?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, I'd have to check on that. I believe the committee can introduce cause bills to be introduced. You couldn't do it in the budget bill.
Okay.
There's a prohibition against that. And I believe you can introduce bills. You'd have to look whether you're looking at combining the operations of two boards or you're looking at back office operations, because they're two different discussions, I believe.
I think that's correct, and one of the things that Dallas is going to refresh the committee on, Adrian Sexton in LFO did an analysis, and that was provided to the committee back in December. We didn't know we were this committee then, and so it's not a voluminous document, and the professional staff is going to get copies of it so we can have it to review. And the Board of Tax Practitioners sat through most of this hearing, so they're on notice that we're going to visit the same question with them tomorrow when their budget comes forward. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Well, without objection, we're adjourned.
I'll get back to Senator Morrison.